It's time for Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway.
Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to Let's Talk. I am Brian Pettaway, your host, and today I've got a really interesting show. It's going to answer some questions that I'm sure that we've asked ourselves over the last 3 years, and that is, are people less patient with each other, less tolerant of each other? Are we generally more confrontational and aggressive with each other than we were prior to COVID-19? I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist or even a social worker, but just based on everyday interactions with people myself and seeing how people interact with each other, I believe COVID-19 has had an effect, and not a positive one, on the population. But I don't know the reasons why. So I have someone here today that is a licensed social worker to discuss this with me and help me figure out what the hell is going on. Anxiety is through the roof with people. It seems like people have lost all impulse control, and I want to know why. I've also got the Petty with me today, and he, of course, is going to be updating us about the world of sports, and I've got this day in history facts coming too, but first you've got me with news and commentary from the past week, so I hope you're feeling great, because I'm feeling great. I've got lots to talk about today, so let's get right to it. All right, obviously, not just locally, but nationally too, the big news, of course, is Marilyn Mosby. She will not, I repeat, she will not be spending any time behind bars. The former top prosecutor of Baltimore City was sentenced to 1 year of home detention and 3 years of supervised release to be served concurrently after two perjury convictions and a mortgage fraud conviction. With those convictions, Marilyn Mosby was facing up to 40 years yesterday when she went in front of Judge Grigsby, with the prosecution asking for at least 20 months. And quite frankly, most experts, law experts, expected she would at least get those 20 months, if not something just short of it. But Judge Grigsby, seeing Mosby now a single mother with both of her daughters in the courtroom in front of her, found some compassion and threw everyone a curveball. And instead of giving Marilyn Mosby jail time, Judge Grigsby sent her home with her children. Obviously grateful, when Marilyn Mosby emerged from the courtroom, this is what she had to say.
I'm just so incredibly grateful. This is not over.
It was a very jubilant and victorious feeling in front of the courthouse yesterday for Marilyn Mosby and her supporters, and understandably so. I mean, whenever you beat jail time, it's a win. However, she will be confined to her home. She will be fitted for an ankle monitor. She will be disbarred and lose her law license and an ability to practice law anywhere in the country. She's had to forfeit the home that she purchased in Florida. She will get the money back on the down payment, and also 10% of whatever it sells for. But she loses a substantial amount of money by having to forfeit that property. This process also took a toll on her marriage, and now she is divorced from former Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby, who now finds himself in the crosshairs of federal prosecutors for committing perjury on his tax returns. Marilyn Mosby now finds herself unemployed from the city of Baltimore as she lost her bid for re-election for city state's attorney. But the biggest thing is, now Marilyn Mosby is a convicted felon, and she will wear that badge for the rest of her life. You know, it struck me that you really don't know what people are going through. You can't base anything just on appearances. It's really interesting to me how things have changed for this couple in such a short period of time. For a while, not long ago, Nick and Marilyn Mosby were the power couple in Baltimore City. Both well-educated, attractive people, both with positions of great influence and power within the city, and both making good money with a combined income of almost $400,000 a year, but somehow fell tens of thousands of dollars behind in their federal taxes, fell months behind on their mortgage payments, and Nick Mosby, as the Baltimore City Council president, was having his wages garnished for non-payment of student loans and also had his car repossessed. I think one of the more stunning things that came out in this trial is how separately Nick Mosby and Marilyn Mosby lived their lives under the same roof. And though that's not uncommon in households of married people these days and how they live, it is one of the major contributing factors as to how Nick and Marilyn Mosby fell so far from grace. So Marilyn Mosby, as you heard, said this is not over. I'm not exactly sure what she meant by that. I don't know what she would appeal, unless it's the forfeiture of the property in Florida that was ruled on by Judge Grigsby that she had to give up. I can't imagine what else it would be. But if I'm Marilyn Mosby, I'm looking at Judge Grigsby, who is also a black woman. And I am thanking Judge Grigsby for giving me every opportunity, A, to defend myself, because, you know, Judge Grigsby caught a lot of heat for changing the venues and postponing the trials until Marilyn Mosby had the proper defense team. And I'm thanking her for having my back, and I'm staying as far away from the courthouse as I possibly can. All right, it is time for This Day in History, and I've got three This Day in History facts for you. And the first one is on this day, May 26, 1897, the first copies of the classic vampire novel Dracula, written by Irish writer Bram Stoker, appeared in London bookshops. What's very interesting about Bram Stoker, besides his imagination, of course, was that he was born an invalid and could barely walk, while he taught himself to walk and grew up to become a football and soccer star at Trinity College in Dublin, Ireland. After graduating from college, he wrote 17 novels altogether, but Dracula eventually earned him literary fame and became known as a masterpiece of Victorian-era Gothic literature. Also on this day, May 26, 1868, President Andrew Johnson was acquitted of a Senate impeachment trial. The interesting thing about Andrew Johnson, he was a Southerner from the seceding and Confederate state of Tennessee that remained loyal to the Union after the Civil War. And because of the loyalty that he showed to the Union, Abraham Lincoln chose him as his running mate during his re-election efforts to show unity to the nation when running for president. But when President Lincoln was shot and assassinated, Johnson took over the presidency and no longer had to hide his racist views. He enacted a lenient Reconstruction policy for the defeated South, including almost total amnesty to ex-Confederates. He gave instant approval of all new local Southern governments, which were able to legislate black codes that pretty much preserved the system of slavery without calling it slavery. And finally, on this day in history, May 26, 1924, President Calvin Coolidge signed into law the Immigration Act of 1924, the most stringent U.S. immigration policy up to the time in the nation's history. The new law reflected the desire of Americans to isolate themselves from the world after fighting World War I in Europe. It also reflected the pervasiveness of racial discrimination in American society, as many Americans saw the enormous influx of largely unskilled and uneducated immigrants coming into the country in the early 1900s, causing, they believed, unfair competition for jobs and land. Under the new law, immigration remained open to those with a college education and/or special skills, but entry was denied disproportionately to Eastern and Southern Europeans and Japanese, while at the same time, the legislation allowed for more immigration from Northern European nations, such as Britain, Ireland, and Scandinavian countries. That sounds familiar. You know what? Perhaps Trump did read history, because when he was in office, all he wanted was immigrants coming in from Scandinavian countries. Remember that part? All right, well, those were the most important and interesting things to me that happened on this day in history, May 26, and I hope that you found them interesting too. All right, it is now time to start talking about our topic for today and what I'm going to be discussing with my special guest, and that is the COVID effect. Now, admittedly, besides documentaries and reading newspapers, I am on social media far too much, and what I see oftentimes with reels and Facebook videos is how intolerant we've become of each other. Anger is the pervasive sentiment in most of these videos that I see. We just have no patience with each other, like zero. The first thing we want to do is argue or fight or call the police. And I'm wondering, was it always like this and now we just have cameras to see it? Or if it's become more prominent since we got out of our hibernation due to COVID-19. Now, what I will say is I've looked at some of the numbers of the CDC, and the numbers do reflect what my eyes see and what my mind computes, and that it is not my imagination. Violent crimes in major cities is up 39%. The public school system in major cities have lost up to 47% of their teachers, claiming that they are leaving either through early retirement or just quitting because of unruly children and disciplinary problems. Alcoholism is up 10%. Suicide is up 17%. Domestic abuse is up 28%. All of these numbers I'm reading are numbers that are increases since 2020. I'm not a genius, but I figured it has to do something with COVID-19. I mean, it has to, right? But I am not a psychologist or psychiatrist or social worker or anything of that kind, okay? So I needed to get someone, I needed to get one of those people to help me put in perspective why this is a thing. And fortunately, I was able to snag such a person. Her name is Latavia Little, and she is a social worker. She has a Master of Social Work degree from the University of Maryland, and she has served as a clinical director and executive director of a substance abuse treatment and prevention program serving adolescents and young adults in two Baltimore City locations for over 15 years. Her current role is as faculty at the School of Social Work as a clinical assistant professor and program director of behavioral health. And though I don't believe she's Jamaican, Latavia has another job. She also works as a mental health clinician in the emergency department at a hospital in the University of Maryland system and is in private practice primarily serving African-American adolescents and adults. Latavia is interested in the historical context of depression and anxiety in African-American females and how poverty impacts mental health. So yes, I got lucky and I was able to snag somebody whose whole life is centered around helping people with anxiety, with depression, and helping them develop coping skills and mechanisms to get through these things. But what she's also going to do, because she sees it so much, is try to tell me or explain to us as listeners why this is a thing and why it is ramped up since 2020. So without further ado, without wasting any more time, let's sit down and have this conversation with Latavia. All right, Let's Talk and 1500 Family, please help me welcome to the set Latavia Little. How you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Brian?
I am well. I appreciate you taking your time with me today. I really, really do.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Let me ask you a question. I know what you do, kind of, but why do you do it?
It's interesting that you ask that because it's not kind of what I started out doing. But I think I found myself always in settings where I was talking to people, working with people, and really found that that was kind of my gift. I started off working with families and children, and I decided to go back to school to get my master's degree. And here I am now. Primarily, I work with African-American women, and my focus is really on supporting women to be their best selves and also navigating some of the challenges that we as mothers, friends, partners, we are in so many roles and so many people rely on us that often our needs go unmet. And so I really aim to help women to be powerful, to be well, and to be happy in whatever way they define happiness.
Okay. And I'm sure that all of these ladies listening will will appreciate that today. There's so many things going on right now in the country. And I wanted to touch base with you because I was having a conversation about how people are interacting with each other, right? And you being in social work, you encounter all kinds of people, not just women. And you help all kinds of people. And I know that you've noticed, too, how people interact. And I think, and this could be my imagination, but according to statistics in the CDC, it's not. But I've thought and I've seen that people interact with each other differently, with less patience. It seems like they're more combative since COVID-19. Have you found that to be the case?
I would agree with that. I do think that relationships and people's ability to connect and our overall connectedness has been impacted since COVID. It definitely has changed. And I think the assumption was that when the pandemic subsided, things would go sort of back to normal or to a new normal, as we often talk about it. But I do find that people struggle now a lot more than ever to connect with each other and to maintain relationships, even with relationships that had been forged and established prior to COVID.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like the perfect storm, unfortunately, when you have the advent of internet and social media growing, and then you're locked down for pretty much a year or more. People were already becoming more independent of each other. And then you have, you know, the lockdown, and you have to be, and you learn to be, to learn to live without being in touch with each other. When the gates open back up, you almost don't want to be involved with each other, or you don't know how anymore. And so I was looking at the statistics from the CDC, and they were saying that violent crime since before the pandemic, it's up 39% in most cities, right? And teachers, educators, you know, grade school from kindergarten up until 12th grade, you know, they've lost 48% of all teachers in the country since that time, either retirement, early retirement, or they're calling a teacher abandonment. They're attributing it to disciplinary problems. Mm-hmm. How do we get that back? Like, how do we go back to where it was, or can we?
That is a hard question. It's a good question, but it's a hard question. I think that there are a lot of factors that go into how that question would be answered. I know I recently had a conversation with a friend, and I was talking about the fact that, you know, people spend a lot of time at work, and that's where a lot of relationships, you know, start, and long-term relationships and strong relationships start. But then the pandemic hit, and people, when it was time to go back, people weren't necessarily excited about that,
right.
Even though they knew that they could, you know, as an opportunity to reconnect with old friends.
Right.
It's almost like they, you know, they abandoned those relationships in lieu of being able to stay home and work from the comfort of their own home or not work at all. You know, we saw employment dynamics changed quite a bit as well. And I just think that one of the things we have to look at when we look at young people and how they relate and how they behave in terms of disciplinary problems is they are watching the adults around them,
right,
in terms of what we do and how we relate to each other. And when you talk about the crime and the impatience that we have with each other and how we tend to relate in a negative manner when we're short with each other, we're not kind to each other, I think that young people, even children, young children, they see that. That becomes their measure for how to deal with relationships, how they tolerate other people. And unfortunately, that has become the metric. And so I think that in the education system, when teachers feel like they are not able to make the impact that they want, I think sometimes they decide to do other things because it becomes just too difficult.
Yeah, what are you finding mostly personally when you deal with patients or clients? What are you running into that you didn't before, or running into more of that you did before?
People are a lot more anxious. People are a lot more worried, and people are a lot more sad in terms of their mood. And often, what I'm seeing is that it's not necessarily related to any one incident or event. So it used to be where, you know, something happened, a relationship ended, a death occurred, there was something significant that might have happened to impact someone, and it would change, you know, how they reacted, call on them to, you know, pull out coping strategies that they may not have had to use before. But now it's more vague. I have a lot of patients who can't necessarily point to why they feel the way they feel. They can't necessarily explain why they always feel anxious and on edge. So, you know, a lot of times we're looking at trying to figure out what has triggered this, what has changed over time. Sometimes patients are able to identify that it has been related to the pandemic or and how they've had to cope or adapt following the pandemic. But a lot of times it's just these feelings that people are just not able to figure out what to do with, and it really does interfere with their daily functioning.
You know, you made a good point, something I didn't think about, and that was, you know, people... I guess we actually needed those water cooler conversations on Monday morning. We needed to have that camaraderie from the workplace. I didn't really think about that. And it's a very, very good point. So do you think that working remotely is more damaging, obviously, than actually having people in the workplace? You think that's more damaging to our personalities and our social skills?
See, now you're trying to get me in trouble. Because...
No.
You know, there are a lot of people who are, you know, finding evidence and making cases for never, ever going back into the office. But
right.
Yes, I do think that working from home and not having any type of requirement or even desire to go into the office on any consistent basis, I do think it does damage to us. We are made to connect with each other. We are human beings, and that is what we were created to do,
right.
To support, to interact, to, you know, be able to collaborate and do things together. So that's what the whole concept of team is, right? And
right.
So if you're never coming together and being able to exchange ideas in person in a real organic and authentic way, Zoom is a very effective way of working, but I do think there's a lot that's lost with that. I mean, think about the Zoom platform. You may or may not have your camera on. You have no idea of whether or not the other people are really engaged or multitasking or not even at the computer at all.
Right.
You know, there are so many opportunities to disconnect, to be distracted, you know, to zone out. And all of that, yes, I think it affects our relationships. I know that for me, for example, I enjoy just the whole activity of preparing myself to be able to go in and to meet with colleagues. I also enjoy not having to do it every day.
Right.
But those times when I am required to go into it, those few times a week, it's rejuvenating for me because I'm able to connect with like-minded individuals, with other professionals who challenge me, who get me you know, to think about things in a different way, who are actually teaching me as well and learning from me, you know, so there's an exchange there. And I don't think that it happens in the same way, in the same valuable way, when you are never able to come together in person physically.
So you think maybe a hybrid schedule is probably the best option, like maybe a 3-2, 3-on-2,
yes.
2 from home. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I would recommend.
Okay. Yes. What about teachers, man? Teachers have really caught it. I mean, they caught it when kids weren't in the classroom because they were saying test scores were low and so they weren't doing their jobs. And when the kids come back to the classroom, it's like they've lost all sense of decorum and knowing how to act in a classroom setting. And so how do we get these kids back? Because teachers aren't getting the support from parents. So how do we get these kids back to a place where they understand what a teaching setting should look like or a learning setting should look like?
Well, I guess we would have to look at, you know, what's missing. I know when I had school-aged children, one of the things that I felt was missing was, and I don't mean this in a negative or a critical way, but I always felt like a critical piece of training or teaching that's missing from a teacher's, I guess, educational requirements is classroom management. And maybe it is a big proponent of their curriculum.
Right.
But what I found was that there's an expectation that every child is coming with the same intention, with the same needs, the same desires, and that's to learn and to matriculate. But I don't think that that's true because I think that young people, and especially now in the world that we live in, are coming from so many different environments and backgrounds that in some cases, education is the least of their needs, the least of their worries. Education is a value. And if that's something at home where you are pushed out of the door every day because you are busy, you are annoying, you are, you know, another mouth to feed. So school is a place for babysitting. School becomes a babysitter,
right.
You know? So I recognize that when children come into the classroom, teachers have an expectation that they've prepared for these students and they want to impart something to these students, but the children are not always ready to receive or in the same place in terms of how they receive information. And so that becomes a classroom management issue where teachers are trained and receive some of the same training that social workers receive around human behavior and the hierarchy of needs and being able to look at students really individually and say, hey, this is a student that shows up every day, right? And we know that if you're showing up every day, that's a strength, actually. But they're showing up every day and they're distracting the classroom. They're disrupting, you know, the flow of what's supposed to go on a daily basis. So, you know, the teacher has to be skilled in knowing what to do with the student. You know, do you punish? Do you correct? Do you remove? Or do you engage? Do you pull in? Do you really assess and say, hey, something's going on. This student can get here every day, but they're showing that they have different needs. They're showing deficits that I don't see in other children over here. And so really trying to figure out what can I do. And it's challenging for teachers because they may have four or five different sets of kids with different types of needs.
Right.
And so how do you manage that? You know, that's a real challenge. How do you manage that? Why do you think teachers flock to the teacher's pet? Because they don't require anything more from them except for them to work in their craft, and that's to teach. But that's not what they're getting these days.
So two questions in reference to the teachers and the kids, and I'll leave that one alone. How do you feel about cell phones in classrooms? Do you think that kids should have to surrender their cell phones before the classes start? And the other is do you think teachers should get different training when hired than they have gotten previously, dealing not just with the education side, but the disciplinary side?
There you go, trying to get me in trouble again, Brian, with the cell phone issue. I think that cell phones, when it comes to cell phones, first of all, I think that there should be different rules based on the age of the children.
Okay,
right?
That's fair.
So you're talking about kindergartners versus high schoolers, right? And I think the first question needs to be, what is the purpose? What would be the reason that a child would need a cell phone in the classroom or would need to put a cell phone away? So for example, we know that in our society, our children are hyper-focused on their phones and electronic devices.
Right.
And that's from the very small to the older teens and young adults. And so if that is a way that we can use technology to engage young people, to teach young people, I'm all for it. But if it is a device that is distracting young people and creating ways that, you know, children recognize that there are vast differences between, you know, me and this person over here, you know, because it can become an access issue as well, right?
So
one child may have the latest iPhone and another child may have no phone or may have an Android. And we know there's a whole silly comparison that goes on between Android users and iPhone users.
Correct.
So you gotta kind of keep that in mind too. So what is the purpose? What would be the purpose? If I were a teacher, what I would do is try to figure out ways where the phone is not used necessarily all the time, but times when I could say, okay, bring out your phones, we're going to play a game, or, you know, we have this. My son does it now. He's in high school, and there are times when he can have his phone, but it's directed. It's not where he just has to have his phone, and there are some times where they have the little pocket cubbies,
yeah,
where he does have to surrender his phone, because these kids are savvy, right? So they're slick. And so teachers know that. And so they want your undivided attention. And so they figure out ways to get you to disconnect and distract. But so that you're not distracted. But if they can figure out, you know, creative ways to use technology to engage young people, then I think that that is totally appropriate to use.
Okay. Okay.
And then you asked about training.
Yes.
So just going back to what I was saying before, I do think that some of the training that teachers have to be, should be exposed to is around disciplinary practices. It is around, you know, working with children recognizing differences. I imagine that they do quite a bit around cultural sensitivity training. We have a lot of mixed populations that are in classrooms together. So helping helping teachers to have an appreciation of different cultures, but helping other students and bringing the classroom together as a unit so that they are learning about each other's cultures and backgrounds and having a real appreciation for different cultures and different you know, ways of living. I think that that's important. And I also think that, like I said, there's a piece, a social work piece that would benefit teachers if they were able to really be able to identify when there is a unique need that's going to have a significant impact on a child's learning and be able to address that very quickly. When children are identified as being a problem, that is what they will exhibit and right. give you exactly right. what it is once you label them, right? And children can pick up right away once, you know, I'm the one that I get the sighs and the rolling of the eyes and, you know, the mumbling, and that child over there gets the smiles and, you know, the warm greetings and gets to do extra things in the classroom, help and pass out the papers and collect the pencil. You know, children pick up on that. And those messages that they get, children internalize them, and that becomes then their identity that they've taken on. Because keep in mind, and I've always said this, if I had time to go back to school, I would change professions and I would be a teacher.
Oh, wow.
Because teachers, I would, because teachers have such a significant impact on a child's development that it's just not funny. I mean, right. teachers really can, they can really help a children's love for learning, a child's love for learning thrive, or they can really put a damper on a child's confidence in themselves and their ability to be successful in a learning environment. So teachers are very, very powerful, in my opinion. And I think that they, you know, they recognize that. I think a lot of teachers do recognize that. But I think that teachers, and especially recently, teachers do not get the support that they need.
Absolutely
around
not.
Around disciplinary
right.
Behavior, around training that they need. I think the training comes very slow. I think it's very reactive instead of proactive. And I think that teachers are burnt out. You know,
definitely.
In social work, that's a term that we use very often. Just, you know, always, you know, hearing other people's trauma and dealing with that and how we internalize it. But I think teachers, there's a real teacher burnout that we're seeing too. When you talk about these teachers that are leaving the field,
right?
And you can't figure out what they're doing. I think they're burnt out because they haven't been properly supported and trained.
Without a doubt. You said earlier that kids mimic what they see the adults do. And I've noticed that adults seem to have less and less patience and tolerance of each other. And the impulse control seems to have gone away. Do you think that there's something that has gone on with maybe the vaccinations that we've taken? Or I can't imagine. We're just so quick to judge. We're so quick to react. Mm-hmm. Anger is a more popular, I guess, outcome of a situation than grace. And I'm trying to figure out, where does that come from? What happened?
Well, I can't intelligently comment on the vaccine and its effects. And I wouldn't want to because I am vaccinated. So
So am I.
Then I would be commenting on what has happened with myself too. But no, I think that there has just been a real shift in our society. There's a lot. Like there's just a lot there when you talk about what has happened. You know, and if we go back to the pandemic, there's a lot of repercussions. And I remember when we were going through the pandemic, I remember saying to myself, we are going to see the effects of this for years and years to come.
Right.
So we're talking about, you know, a significant increase in depression and anxiety. So, you know, the studies that have been done, they show that, you know, depression and anxiety now are down or you know, coming down, but it's still much higher than it was pre-COVID,
right?
You're talking about the financial strain that has happened as a result of COVID, with the loss of jobs or the reduction in hours, people having to shift. And there are a lot of people who just reinvented themselves through COVID, right? They found something totally different to do or added to what they were already doing. Remember that how social media now, how it plays out, you know, not just with young people, with adults too, how we use technology and social media and how, you know, a lot of people are falling into that comparison trap of seeing what they think they see and they think is going on with others, and they're comparing it to themselves and feeling inadequate or less than, right? So people having to go through new routines, there's a lot of uncertainty and fear. People are lonely, you know, there's information overload, there's misinformation, there's rumors. So when you talk about a spike in the level of stress this high, it's affecting people's sleep, it's affecting people's mood, there's more substance use. All of this that we look at, right, whenever there's a prolonged periods of high stress, it affects us physically and mentally, right? And not everybody is getting help or addressing it. Not everybody even recognizes that it is an issue. And so when you say what has happened, I think all of these things are going on. And let me not even touch on race relations in the country, right, and around the country, and how that really, you know, there's this term, race-based traumatic stress,
right?
You know, and so look at all of those words that put together, you know, trauma, stress, race, like you put those three together and that's like a cocktail for you know, disaster. And so we have all of these things at play and people are still trying to do this thing called living. That's what's going on when we talk about and then there's a like you said, a lack of regard for each other, where people are just not as interested as, like you said, figuring out what could be going on with my sister, my brother, this other person.
Right.
It's all about how you've made me feel, how I feel wronged now. But that goes back to how we relate to people. That goes back to how we're feeling and whether our mood is regulated or unregulated. And so, you know, I think that more people need to be more in tune with how they're feeling, how they're relating, and how they're reacting. And I think that there are a lot of people who are dealing with a lot of all of this cocktail of stress that I talked about, and they're not necessarily taking care of themselves or know what to do to take care of themselves to get themselves back to the place where we, quote, used to be.
Is it your hope that as the depression and the anxiety subsides from having been locked up the way that we were, do you think things will get back to a more tolerant environment than it is now?
I certainly hope so. So I consider myself to be a very optimistic person, and that is what keeps me working. Certainly, I have to feel like things are going to get better, and what I do makes a difference. But I do think that you know, there has to be a conscious effort to really pay attention to our mental health. And I think that we have, overall, we are paying more attention to our mental health. And when I say we, I'm specifically talking about the African-American population. I think that we are much more in tune to the fact that we need help. We are much more comfortable with asking for help. There's a lot less stigma surrounding asking for help. And people are exercising different options for getting help. Not everybody has to be in traditional therapy that goes on and on for years and months. You know, there are different ways that people can seek support. And let's not, you know, minimize the importance of our support networks. You know, it's very important to have people who recognize that you may be struggling, people who hold you accountable for your bad behavior and cheerlead you when you are doing something good, you know. So it's not always necessarily a traditional way that we have to get help in terms of, you know, seeking therapy. And then there's, for African Americans, there's the faith-based community, you know,
right.
That's very important for us as well. And that definitely plays a significant role in our mental wellness. So yes, it is my hope that things will continue to improve, particularly in our community. And, you know, when I think about what I do, I'm focused on one person at a time, helping to support them and navigate their challenges.
What kind of advice do you give people? Is it to come out and be around people to to be in more public settings more often than you are or having currently been? Like, what is the advice that you give people to, I don't know, to get back to where we were?
I think that a lot of the things that I talk about with my clients who are seeking support is doing a lot of the basic things that we hear about all the time. And basically it has to do with taking care of both your body and your mind. Right. So when you're talking about taking care of your body, you want to give it what it needs and you want to avoid what it does not need. So you want to be trying to get the right amount of sleep for you. Right. And that's for you. So right. Whereas one person may need 8 or 9 hours, someone else may be able to function optimally on 5 or 6. But you need to know what it is that you need because, you know, you need sleep in order to focus, in order to be productive, right? Moving your body, any amount of movement that you can do on a regular basis is a good thing. And exercise reduces anxiety and it improves mood. You want to watch what you're putting in your mouth. You know, you want to choose foods that are high in protein and vitamins and minerals. You want to avoid things that are foods that are high in fats and salts and sugar. And, you know, let's talk about substance use. You want to avoid tobacco, alcohol, drugs, you know. When you're talking about misuse, tobacco is a different issue because we know that tobacco is harmful. It can increase your risk of lung disease. But alcohol, you know, even drugs that are used recreationally, everything needs to be used in moderation and should not be used as a way to cope and as a way to manage your feelings. If you find that that's what you're doing, then that's a signal that you probably could use some support, you know, different type of support. And then you want to take care of your mind as well. You know, you want to disconnect, take some time out. You know, sometimes you know, all of the things when we talk about, you know, that buzzword now, self-care.
Right.
You know, whatever that means for you, self-care has to do with you finding those things that help you to feel well and to, you know, disconnect. And you want to, like you said, you talked about getting out and being with people. Yes, absolutely. Get involved, volunteer. You know, that helps you to feel connected. It creates a support network for you. It gives you a sense of purpose when you can give back. And you recognize also that there are other issues that are larger than you. It fosters a sense of gratefulness. And, you know, in terms of us not always striving to be perfect, perfection is not necessarily realistic. We have to learn to do our best and be satisfied with that, you know, and taking a time out to care for yourself. I had a friend, a girlfriend of mine told me, she owed me a phone call back, and she called me several days later, and I didn't think anything of it, but she called me several days later, and she was like, I apologize that I'm just getting back to you. She said, but I had to get away. I disconnected for a few days. I went away just by myself. And so I asked, oh, I felt great. I said, well, how'd that feel? You know, did you like it? Was it worth it? She said, yes. She said, I didn't realize how important it was until I actually did it. You know, so we got to be conscious about taking care of ourselves, doing what it is that we need to do to foster our own wellness. Self-care is such a cliche word, kind of, but it is such a necessary.
It's definitely important.
Practice.
It is absolutely important.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, you have your own practice.
I do.
And how can people get a hold of you if they need the help?
People can get a hold of me through email, through phone. I'm not on a lot of the social media outlets. Honestly, a lot of my clients have come to me through word of mouth and through referral. So many so that I don't, I'm turning people away all the time.
Okay.
But even when people reach out to me, and I'm happy for people to reach out to me, if I cannot assist, I do my best to connect them to other clinicians who I think will be a good fit.
Okay. All right. Now, do you want to give out your email?
Yes. The email is transformand, transformandrenewyou@gmail.com. And all of those words are written out. So transformandrenewyou@gmail.com. And I'll just say, put it out there. When I was doing that email address, I was not thinking it did not have to be that long.
You should have seen me sitting here. I'm thinking, wow, that's a lot.
Every time I give it out, I'm like, let me say it before you say it. It is too long. But it's connected to a lot of things now, so I just haven't changed it. But yes, transformandrenewyou@gmail.com.
Okay. Well, listen, Latavia, I appreciate your time today. I'm sure you'll be getting some some emails from people because you seem like you have all the answers. You dropped some real knowledge on us today, and I appreciate you very much.
I'm glad I was able to.
All right, well, we'll be in touch. You're now officially a member of the Let's Talk family, and if I need you, I'll be reaching back out to you again.
Okay, great. Thanks. It's been great talking to you.
You too, Latavia. You take care now.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, well, it's good to know it wasn't my imagination about this whole COVID-19 thing. We are all feeling the effects of it. None of us are immune to it. I'm sure all of us have our anxiety and our... And, you know, we're just not as patient as we used to be, but we've got to slow down. We've got to get back to a point where we're giving each other grace. It was great to hear from Latavia Little. I will be calling her again, but I know you hear the music. That means only one thing on this show, and that means it is time for the petty. Let's give him a call and see what he's talking about today.
Happy Sunday morning to you, Brother B.
Good morning to you, sir. Happy Sunday. How you doing, brother?
Yeah, I'm just good. You see, I'm back to the Brother B thing. So I'm doing well. And you know what? Believe it or not, I usually don't feel this way around this time of year, but I got to because, all honesty, it's playoff time.
It is playoff time.
And when I say playoff time, I'm talking about the NBA, some of the NHL. And I'm even talking about the UFL. It's that time of year where these teams are getting to playoff mode.
It is. It definitely is. I can feel it too, man. It feels great.
And so I'm going to start with the least amount that I can talk about. Let's talk about the UFL because it looked like it's going to be the Birmingham Stallions, who are still undefeated, against the Michigan Panthers in the USFL division. And then the XFL division is going to be the St. Louis Battlehawks and the San Antonio Brahmas. Now, my money is on St. Louis Battlehawks from the XFL against the Birmingham Stallions from the USFL. And I'm telling you, Brother B, because I've watched Birmingham, I really think that they will be the first UFL champions.
What happened to the Defenders? I mean, going into this season, we both thought that the Defenders would be the odds-on favorite.
Well, you know, because they've mixed the two leagues together, I think they kind of ran into a little bit of a buzzsaw. And it was a little harder than what they thought it was going to be. And I do believe that a couple of players defected to the NFL. The USFL was a whole different monster. And they looked good. But right now, it's just totally something different.
Right.
You know, I'm going to talk about this in a couple of minutes, about all the leagues, the UFFL, UFF. The NFL, and even the CFL, because the Canadian Football League will start their season on June the 6th.
Okay.
But right now, I'm looking at St. Louis Battlehawks against the Birmingham Stallions. We'll see how that plays out. Now, in the NBA, we're back to the Final Four with them, the Dallas Mavericks and the Minnesota Timberwolves, along with the Boston Celtics and the Indiana Pacers. To me, this is a no-brainer. I'm thinking Dallas and Boston in the finals.
Okay. All right.
And if we get to that point, and I think we will, I'm thinking Dallas will take it all. Dallas is looking very good. Doncic is looking good. Kyrie Irving. You know, Uncle Drew is doing his thing.
Right.
And I think they're just a little bit too much for Boston. I really do.
Okay.
But I'm looking for those two to be matched up in the NBA finals. Moving right along, let's talk about the NHL. You got the New York Rangers and the Florida Panthers, the Dallas Stars and the Edmonton Oilers. Now, who I think is going to be in it and who I like to see are two different things. I would like to see the New York Rangers and the Edmonton Oilers play. I really would. I think that would be a very good matchup for the NHL. But I have a feeling it's going to be Florida and Edmonton.
Okay. All right.
And I'm going to see how that plays out. Now, we're going to talk about your high-flying O's real quick. They are three back and behind those damn Yankees. They still hold a good spot in the wild card position. I do believe as the season goes on, they'll do like they did last year, and they will overcome those Yankees and will win the AFC, the American League East. I just have a feeling that they're going to get it done.
Okay. You know, no, they just got swept, didn't they?
You know, it's only May. It's a whole lot of baseball needs to be played, and I just have a feeling that the Orioles are going to, just like they did last year, they will catch those damn Yankees,
right,
and they will be
right
in first place.
Okay.
But the surprise of the major leagues has to be those Philadelphia Phillies. They boast the best league in baseball right now. And that's a surprise to me and everyone. Because everybody's putting their money on the Dodgers. With all of that money spent, they figured that the Dodgers would be the team to beat. Well, right now, it looks like it might be the Phillies.
You know what, bro? When Turner joined the Phillies, and they had Harper, their lineup was, I mean, it is what it is. I'm surprised that they weren't getting this done last year. They're a hell of a team.
Well, you know, Brother B, this is how I feel. When you go to a new team, you have to gel with that team. I think that there may have been a thing where Trey Turner came and said, I got to gel with the Phillies.
Right.
And now they're putting it all together. And he's coming off an injury list. So it's like now he's back. You had some young players that they had called up. They were doing their thing. They had a tough time deciding who they want to send back down or who they want to get rid of.
Right.
Because they were just firing on all cylinders. The pitching looks good, and their biggest goal was to win the National League East, to not be a wild card team. And right now, they are boasting the best league in the, I mean, the best record in the majors.
Okay.
And that's huge.
That is. It definitely is.
No. And this is the thing that gets me. And I don't even want to, I'm to a point where I'm tired of even mentioning her name. Caitlin Clark just inked another big deal with Wilson. They would have a bowl named after her.
I heard.
And that's just crazy.
It's disgusting, really. I mean, it really is.
And this is what's disgusting, that you have people like Charles Barkley and Colin Cowherd defend her. And Colin Cowherd, who I kind of half-ass like, excuse my language, he said something that really disturbed me. He said it was unfair that Caitlin Clark, in her first couple of games, had to play against two of the best teams, you know, defensive-wise. She had to play against the New York Liberty. She had to play against the Connecticut team. And it's like, well, wait a minute. This is where you pull your big girl panties up. This
right
is the big leagues. This isn't college no more.
Right.
Don't make no excuses. Don't say that the WNBA needs to make a softer schedule for her debut. No. She's supposed to be the best one out there. She was the number one draft pick. Throw it to the Wolves and see how she survives. That's how it should have been.
The thing that bothers me the most is she hasn't won anything. She hasn't won a ring in anything. So I'm not understanding. I mean, she's a very good individual player. But until you win some, she hasn't won anything. She hasn't led her team to victory. Her team won their first game. Was it last night? Night before last? I mean, she hasn't done anything.
Well, you know, Brother B, this is the thing. And this is in any sport, be it baseball, basketball, football, I can't say hockey too much, but in any sport, even and really in boxing, and I'm going to get in trouble for this one, but this is how I honestly feel. They are always looking for the great white hope. You recall when Larry Bird came into the NBA, people were ecstatic.
Yeah, but Larry Bird could ball.
Yeah, he can ball.
Larry Bird was a beast.
I gotta give it to Larry Bird. But it was like, oh my God, Larry Bird is here. But if you realize, Larry Bird started the same time Magic did.
Yeah, he did. He did. He did. He,
you know,
he absolutely did. And as much as people like to say racism isn't a part of this country anymore, white people say it all the time, you can always tell when something like this happens because it shows up on his face. It shows up on his face.
And I go back to, she's getting all these accolades, and she has done absolutely nothing in the WNBA. Whereas you have a sister, Asia Wilson,
has done everything,
tearing it up, and you don't hear nothing about her.
She's done everything.
No ball deal. no commercials, no anything.
Nothing.
So if you want to talk about don't make it all about race, seriously, really? That's what we're saying?
Yeah.
It's right there in front of your face. You can't say it's not about race.
Correct.
You can't. Correct. Because it's right there in front of your face.
Speaking of which, how many endorsements, how many commercials have you seen Clarissa Shields in?
I haven't.
Exactly. None. She's a repeated two-time gold medal Olympic boxer, right? The very first. And she has an undefeated record in two weight classes. I mean, and she's got nothing. She's got no endorsements. If she was blonde hair, blue eyed, she'd be all over the place.
And that's what I'm talking about. So don't say it's not about race, because definitely it is. It's right there in front of our faces. Now, I want to touch on something real quick before I get out of here, Brother B.
All right.
The UFL have 8 teams.
Right.
The CFL, Canadian Football League, has 9 teams. And the NFL has 32 teams. Now, when you put all that together, we're talking about close to, 50 teams of professional athletes playing football?
Right.
Right? The NFL will be playing a game in São Paulo, Brazil. São Paulo, Brazil, opening game. Eagles are playing in that game. Now, if the NFL, that's a mega, 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 mega business organization, wants to go to Europe, to South America, to Mexico, okay, follow me with this one. Let's sit down and talk to UFL. Let's talk to the Canadian Football League and say, hey, there are 50 teams out there. Let's all get together and have one big league. And when you talk about champions, when you say they are the world champs, now you have the opportunity to say that these are the world champs of football, because you have the Canadians involved, you have the UFL involved, and if you want to, so it can be an even slate across the board, put a team in Mexico. Put a team over, not so much in Europe, put a team in Mexico, so it evens out across the board. That's just my thoughts.
You can say that. I mean, but you still have you're still playing against American players, right? It doesn't matter where you put an NFL team. If it's an NFL team, you're still playing against American players. So either way, whether those teams are in Barcelona or if they're in Montreal or wherever else, they're still American players, right?
Okay, that is true, but you heard my thoughts. That is just my thoughts. Now,
okay.
If you recall a while back when we were talking about the XFL and the USFL, I said they should merge.
Right.
It happened.
Right.
Might not see it in my lifetime, but there's a strong possibility, and I've been keeping my ear to the ground, and I really haven't heard anything, but there's a possibility, because I'm looking at the NFL exploring at all these other places outside the United States, that we may see a World Football League.
Well, we may, but if that ever happens, people are going to swear up and down that it's a scripted league. They're going to swear up and down. I mean, there's hints of it now, but they're going to swear up and down it's scripted.
Well, like I said, I talked about the USFL. I talked about the XFL. It came to be. So if it happens with the World Football League, you know where you heard it first.
Okay.
On that note, Brother B, I am out of here. Enjoy your holiday weekend. Peace.
Peace, Brother. Peace. All right, well, I mean, you heard it from the Petty first. He thinks there's going to be a World Football League. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. But even if it is, it's just comprised of American football players. So I'm not going to get that excited. But he may be absolutely right. The NFL is a money-making machine. And if they can find a way to make money by putting teams in different countries, that's exactly what they're going to do. I think they tried that once before with, NFL Europe, and it didn't work out. But we'll see what happens. Anyway, listen. The hour has come to an end. I'm so glad that you joined me today. If you missed any portion of this show, you can always go to my website, voiceswired.com. Hit the Let's Talk tab and scroll down. You'll see all of the shows listed there from newest to oldest, and I hope that you enjoy them. Also, if you have any suggestions for me, if you have any feedback about the show, I hope that you get with me at On With Brian Pettaway on Instagram. I love to read the feedback. I love to see your messages, and I really appreciate your opinions. And listen, today is Sunday. Memorial Day is tomorrow, which means you really can chill out today. Do nothing. Swim in a pool with the little ones. Have a great time. But hey, please remember why you have that day off on Monday. It's to honor those that have fallen and gave their lives in sacrifice for this country to protect and defend it. They did it at all costs. And I don't want that to get lost in our celebration. Please, please say a prayer for those, the 1% of those in this country who signed their names on the dotted line. That, hey, if I've got to die fighting for this country, that's exactly what I'll do. Let's say a prayer for them. Let's say a toast for those people that are active and those who have gone before us who did not make it, all right? So listen, enjoy the day. Take a load off. Enjoy all the games that are on today. Relax. Enjoy the pool. Enjoy the barbecues. And do the same thing tomorrow. But Tuesday, wake up invigorated, ready to tackle the world. Because the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. I'll be talking to you next week, same time, same channel, 1500radio.com, Baltimore's authentic multimedia experience. Have a great weekend, people. Peace!